Well, it was great to have that conversation with you yesterday, Abhaya. Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good.
And then afterwards, I was thinking, oh, there were loads of things I didn't ask you, in a way, of a more mundane nature.
Yeah.
But I thought it'd be quite nice to kind of put what we talked about yesterday in context.
Right.
So I'm grateful that you've agreed for me to grill you about that next. So, you were born on the 1st of October, 1936.
Yes.
Whereabouts?
In Chorley, Lancashire.
Ah. And tell me a bit about your family.
I had three. There were four of us. My eldest brother, Frank, died earlier this year at the age of 89. And my elder brother, Jack, who is 5 years older than me, died about 3 weeks ago, a month
Gosh.
Ago. Yeah, before I went to the 80th birthday party a week ago on Saturday, I'd just come back from Southport for Jack's funeral. He was a Catholic priest, my brother Jack, and quite high up in the hierarchy. Not very high up, but pretty high up. And I have a sister, Dorothy, and she's 3 years older than me. And we're close because we're together in age. And my two older brothers were close together because of age, you know. So there are now two of us left.
So you're the youngest of four?
I'm the youngest of four.
And you grew up in a Catholic family?
Very strong Roman Catholic family. Catholicism was sort of rife in the northwest of England in those days. There are five Catholic churches in Chorley. They were always full for every Mass. There were three Masses every Sunday morning. And now apparently there are hardly any going, you know. It's all changed.
So both your parents were involved in the church?
Yes, very much so.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a fitter at Leyland Motors. And then he was promoted to toolmaker. But he didn't like his job. It was not a very good job. And he's quite an intelligent man. And missed out on education because, you know, his parents couldn't afford him to go to grammar school. Kids in those days had to go to the mill or the factories to bring in money. And the same was my mother. She was working in the mill when she was 12 years old.
12?
Yeah. So Chorley's was full of cotton mills in those days.
And did your mum carry on working?
Then my mum... She was from Chorley and my dad was from a village called Brinscombe, but my mum, her parents had this cobbler's shop in Chorley and they changed it. I don't know how she did this, but they changed it into a fish and chip shop. So I grew up, you know, with my mother, my dad away at the war and my mother working 3 days a week at this fish and chip shop. So they were both sort of run off their feet in a way. The elder brothers had to help at the preparing chips, you know. They hated it. They called it the slough of despond.
Very literary way to have
my
your...
brother, that's my eldest brother. Dorothy and I escaped from that.
So your dad was conscripted in the war?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then he came back at the evacuation of Dunkirk and then was demobbed because of his age.
Right.
He was in his early 40s then.
And you mentioned yesterday that you went to a Catholic seminary.
Yeah.
Is that a training to become a priest or is that just a kind of school?
In those days, I don't know what it's like now, but you went at the age of 11. And you were turned out as a priest at the age of 24.
Good grief.
Yeah. And my brother, Jack, went to this seminary in Lancashire. And I idolised him. You know how boys do, they idolise the elder brothers. And he went. It's partly that I went for that reason. Maybe not the only reason.
So you did want to go originally?
I wanted to go to be at the same school as him.
Right.
But... there were other factors which perhaps I wasn't aware of. Anyway, as I told you yesterday, it wasn't the most brilliant place to be. But I did get a good education. And I left when I was 19.
And what did you do when you left?
And then when I left, I hadn't got A levels. I'd only got one A level at this seminary because I didn't do any work. And I wanted to go to university. So a friend got me into Chorley Grammar School, which was a co-educational school.
Gosh, that must have been quite advanced in those days.
Fantastic, after 12 years imprisonment.
Was it residential, the seminary?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 2 weeks at Christmas holiday, go home, and then 7 weeks in the summer. Chorley Grammar School was like, you know, girls all over the place. At last I was free, you know, for all that.
So you had some fun.
And we had fun, but I worked hard because I really was motivated to get to this university. So I did three subjects at A-level.
What did you study?
I studied English, French and Latin. Latin was my best subject in those days. So I got through easily because I worked hard and then went to King's College London for 3 years and got a degree. And then I didn't know what to do, so I took a teacher's certificate, became a teacher at a grammar school in Middlesex. And I taught there for, I think it was 4 years before I transferred to teaching English as a foreign language.
So where are we
in those days, you didn't have to have a qualification for that. So I got the job just through looking at the Times Educational Supplement.
So you started teaching around 1960, something like that?
1961.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, until 1965. Then I went to Thailand. And I told you about that yesterday, you know, the Thailand experience and then coming back and discovering the movement in its infancy.
So that was in 1967?
That was in 1967.
How were you living when you came across the movement? You were living with your wife and family?
I was living with my wife in a little village called Chiseldon. She was living with her mother, whose husband had died 3 months before I left Bangkok. And that was really weird because I'd never met her mother. We got married in Bangkok, like told the family, oh, we're getting married.
So did you meet in Bangkok?
We met in Bangkok.
Ah.
Yeah. And we married at the British Embassy in Bangkok. And my family were really, you know, distraught because, I'd given up the Catholicism. So I hadn't had a Catholic wedding, didn't have a family wedding. But Val's father died 3 months before my contract ended, and she was utterly distraught because she really close to her dad. And I went back to this little village. There's these two women mourning about a man I'd never met. But that was only for a few weeks.
So where's the village?
Chiseldon is in Wiltshire near Swindon.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so nice little village, lovely countryside. And then I got a job in Bournemouth. Bournemouth was a place where there were lots of English language schools. Don't know whether that's still the case. And I got I got a job in quite a good school. And I worked there till 1969. Then dropped out. And we all went to live in Cornwall.
The great Cornish phase that you and Arnada were talking about the other night.
As a result of a very good friend of mine called Brian in Bangkok. And that's when I started smoking dope with Brian. But he sort of took it sacramentally, you know. It was like definitely to do with spiritual matters. He and Alex, my two good friends in Bangkok, they had quite a deep insight, not smoking dope. It was without the dope, and they had sounds very much like a real breakthrough. And they just like gave up everything. His wife, Brian's wife, Bridget, who's a friend of Dharma Vajri, this happened when she'd already left Bangkok, and Brian had fallen in love with one of his students, who was also very much into the Dharma. They came back and set up this sort of community in Millbrook, Cornwall.
Which is very close to where Banti stayed in Marlani's chalet.
Yes. So Banti used to come and visit me. That's how he became familiar with Millbrook and the chalets on the clifftop.
Oh, so it's because you were in Millbrook that
I was in Millbrook,
That's interesting.
And he used to come and visit me. Because I was torn between Brian, who was making himself into a sort of guru, and his teaching, and Bante's, you know. It was very interesting, me inviting Banti to that group and see what his response was. Anyway, The one thing I will say is that these two friends of mine were questioning me very much, and quite not just me, but anyone else they could find, because they wanted to, as it were, they wanted us to see what they had seen. So the motivation was very good, but it was very much along the lines of direct pointing, because I read the book, The Gateless Gate.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, wow, this is just like them, you know. I had my reservations about both of them. They're very good friends and very genuine, lovely people. But they were sort of, this is my impression, sort of emotionally alienated.
Right.
Yeah. I used to argue with them about this. So when I came across direct pointing, I realised, yeah, this is very, very similar. And that was, I had reservations about it. And when I was at Sudarshana Loka last year teaching that retreat, that's when Pema Keto came up to me and said, I noticed, Abhay, you had your name on the list for direct pointing, then you scratched it out. She was just interested to know why, so I told her. I told her what my reservations were. And I said that the first two order members I spoke to, they talked about the breakthrough, but they didn't mention the emotion, you know, like the metta-bhavana or the, like, you know. And I said I felt a bit iffy about that.
Yeah.
But anyway, when I talked to her, I felt really good talking to her. I thought, I can trust this woman. You know, she said, if you're ever into doing it, I'll do it with you. So I said, okay.
And that's what you did?
Yeah. We discussed my reservations and then I said, okay, let's do it. So when I got back from Australia last March, we started. And
the rest is history.
The rest is history. The rest you know about.
So going back to Cornwall in the 1960s, what sort of impression do you think you had of Bhante's teachings at that point when you were...
I was absolutely knocked off my feet.
And was that mainly through doing retreats with him?
There were only two retreats a year, one in summer, one at Easter. So that's, you know, it was like thirsting for.
And were there books at that point?
Not many, really. He gave me a lot of books, but they're like by Suzuki and, you know, there's nothing. I mean, the survey, his survey and the Three Jewels. The Three Jewels had just been published.
Right.
So I worked my way laboriously through these tomes. And I went to see Bhante. He lived in a flat in North London. And I went to see him and stayed in his flat for weekends. But it was great just going down and seeing him and having a lot of time with him. Yeah.
So you had weekends exploring the Dharma one-to-one with him?
Sorry?
You had weekends exploring the Dharma one-to-one.
His friend Terry, who was still living then.
Oh, yeah.
He'd gone away to spend the weekend with his girlfriend. So it was just me and Bhante.
So that was the late 60s?
That was 68, 69, 70. I spent quite a lot of time one-to-one with Bhante. And then the movement started to mushroom a bit and that phase ended.
And when were you ordained?
1974.
Ah, so there's a bit more story to come then between that time and when you got ordained.
I kept it at a certain distance for quite some time.
And what were you living on then? Because were you still teaching or...?
No, we dropped out, so I got savings. And we got teachers' insurance money. Well, pension money.
Oh.
So we lived a bit on that.
Right.
And then eventually ran out and just signed on. So we dropped out and were real hippies, you know.
Did you have long hair?
Yeah, I had long hair, but it was already going, you know, at the top. But I just made it enough to have long hair, really long.
Oh, the big beard.
The big beard.
I remember Ananda talking about that, because there's that story about him coming to find you in Cornwall.
Right.
Sitting in the local pub, like the local bard, as he puts it, with your big beard. Wanting to find out if you wanted to be ordained.
That's right.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember that aspect. I vaguely remember him coming and finding me in that pub. I don't know where I'd gone there on my own. It was a difficult time. You know, it was like the beginning of the spiritual, the beginner's mind had finished, and there was this conflict between me and Brian, and also, you know, the Bhante teaching and where I was in the situation in Millbrook. It was very difficult. And we're living together in Bridget's house, two families in this small terraced house. So that brought its problems.
Mm. So when were your children born?
Louise was born in Bournemouth while we were still in Bournemouth before we dropped out. Dan, the second child, was born in the house we bought next door to Bridget's.
Right.
After a year, we couldn't stand it any longer. So we bought, especially me and Bridget. And I bought the house next door using our teachers, the pension money, and a £200 loan from my brother Frank. And we bought this house for £2,600. I got a mortgage. I walked into a building society. I got a mortgage straight away. And I dropped out. I was teaching at that time. I was teaching at a secondary modern school in Plymouth. And on the strength of that, I got a mortgage immediately.
Mm.
And then Bhante and Vajukumara, he was living with him, and then decided to move to Norfolk. I can't remember how that came about. Well, the whole family moved to this family community with Sona and Srimala and her kids.
So where are we now?
That's in Tittershaw in Norfolk.
And what year, roughly?
Huh?
What year?
About 1973.
Right.
Maybe 1974. Yeah.
So it's getting near to when you were ordained. Hey? Getting near to the time you were ordained.
Yeah, I've been in Abhirati, we call the house. I was ordained when I was living in Abhirati in 1974. And then it all broke up, it all fell to pieces. And Val went back to Norfolk, to Cornwall. Mm. We still have the house.
Oh, yeah.
And then I did a carpentry course, one of these six-month government courses.
An MSc scheme or something?
It was, I can't remember what you called it. But it was a very good course, actually, fully financed by the government. And
so what made you decide to do that?
Eh?
What made you decide to do a carpentry course?
I don't know. It's interesting, actually, because several years later, many years later, someone did my, what do you call it, the stars and...
Oh, astrological chart.
Yes. Yes, this friend of mine's girlfriend did this astrological chart, and it was interesting. What interested me about it was it said at a certain point, because of the confluences of whatever it was, it seemed very important to do something with your hands. Because I'd always been a head type, really.
Yeah.
Right throughout my life. I found that carpentry course incredibly difficult.
Ah.
Because I've never, ever done anything like that at all.
Mm.
And it was all very sort of, you know, in a way, mathematical background, and you've got to measure and do things. And it was so difficult. But it was a good thing to do because it started another side of me in operation.
Mm.
And then I was able to go to Sukhavati in 1978 and work for a year as a carpenter under Attila's superb tuition.
Is Attila a carpenter by training?
He was a general builder, but his dad was mainly a carpenter.
Mm.
His dad was a carpenter. It was in his blood.
Ah.
So I worked with Attila in 1978, the whole of 1978, until the LBC, Sukhavati as it was called then, was opened.
Mm. That was right at the end of the building project.
Yeah.
Because it had been going for a few years by then.
It had been going for a few years, yeah. Mm. But...
So you were in Norfolk, and you learnt to be a carpenter, and then eventually you came from Norfolk.
Yeah, and anyway, so I found this house in a village near Norwich, in Brundle, and we bought it for £7,100 and sold the house we bought in Cornwall for £2,600. We sold it for £7,000. So we moved to Brundle, and Val's still there. I was there last weekend.
She's in the same house?
That little house. It's been extended a bit. She got a government grant.
Gosh.
She loves it because it's sort of in the country. yeah. with lovely view out of the front and swampy land they'd never build on. Mm. So she keeps on saying, oh, I'm so pleased we bought this house, you know.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you were there for a few years and then you moved down and you were living and working at Sukhavati.
Not long. I worked at Sukhavati until, and then Four Corners Films, just down the road from Sukhavati until
So
spring.
That was a team-based Right Livelihood business?
Yeah. Hmm. Until spring 1979, and then I moved to Padmalaka, which was also very painful because Lal didn't want me to do that.
Hmm.
And then in 1979, yeah, I moved there, and I was not happy at Padmalaka. It was very, very difficult, partly because of the split, you know. The children, too, you know, like I'd go for weekends and it was like, go back to Padmalaka. It's very difficult.
Mm.
Yeah.
How long were you at Padmalaka for?
A year and a half. And then there were difficulties in the Norfolk, in the Norwich Buddhist Centre. And Bante suggested, to my delight, partly because it was an escape from Padmalaka, that perhaps I should consider taking over as chairman. So I became chairman of Norwich Buddhist Centre in 1981.
Ah, right. So you were living in Brundle and being the chair of the Norwich Buddhist Centre?
I was then living in the men's community at Vajrakula in All Saints Green.
The legendary Vajrakula, I've heard of that.
Vajrakula.
So who else was there?
And there was me, and Sadaloka was a mitra when I moved in.
Mm.
Dave Luce, he was very unhappy.
Oh.
And but he had the commitment, I could tell. So when Bante set up this first Tuscany, Subhuti said to a few of us, you know, is there anyone else you think? He'd already invited half a dozen people. So I said, well, I think this chap, Dave Luce, should go.
I found myself wanting to say again, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
You've had a hand in a lot of key moments, haven't you?
Yeah. And then in 1984, I went to Tuscany to be on the support team.
Right.
And that was great. A lot of contact with Bante. He was very relaxed on that course. A lot of close contact with him. And I said, I want to stop being chairman and do a lot of writing, you know. And he was very supportive. But Sadaloka wasn't when I got back. He didn't want to do it. I just wanted to hand it over to him. It was a little bit irresponsible, really, because I don't think he was quite ready. He could have done it. So I hung on for another year as chairman. And then he said, OK, I'll do it.
Right.
So I went off on a 3-month solitary. And what did I do then? I came back to Vajrakula for while he was chairman, just for a few months, and met Vajrin.
Ah.
Yeah.
Adam Malin.
I shared a room with Vajrin, Adam Malin.
Mm.
That was interesting. I was going to see him, but it's, you know, he lives in Bath. It's just too much in. I haven't seen him for years. I don't know whether he's on the edge of things now or not.
He's very busy with his career, and
he's
got very into sporting pursuits since he passed 50. He does marathons and Ironman.
And his children must have grown up now, because they were like 14 and 12 when I went 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It's nice to see him. But I decided not to.
So we've got to the mid-80s. Is that you're living at Vajrakula?
That was 1984.
Yeah.
And then in 1985, Sadaloka said, OK, he'd do it. And then I spent the next year writing an autobiography.
Ah.
Yeah, from birth to meeting Bante. And I finished that a year later, something like 1986. Then there was turmoil at Padmalaka, and poor old Vajranda was chairman. they used to do these retreats, you know, all the ordination retreats at Padmaloka, and they weren't going well, and things were a bit pear-shaped at Padmaloka. Mm. And there's a big sort of... And Subhuti then took over. Bhante told Subhuti to take over the ordination course.
Oh, right.
And poor old Vajrananda was just burnt out. Mm. And he came up to me one day and said, look, how about us living together, sharing a house in Norwich? I said, yeah, fine. So I looked around and found this house, and we shared a house in Norwich. That was where Vajrananda, he's a very good artist. He's just a natural. Mm. All those brothers are just natural artists. Mm. So we did this. I was doing this book on the right side of the brain one. You know,
oh, yeah, yeah.
And Vajrananda was already a very good artist. So I would do drawings. This was only about 3 weeks we did it. Mm. And he would sort of direct me and search you. That was great. But then I didn't do any. I just dropped that and got onto the... Oh, I was on the Manpower Services. No, it wasn't called the Manpower Services, but it was some government project whereby I could sign up as a writer, part-time writer, and part-time teacher of English.
Huh?
That's the wrong language. So I went around all the schools in Norwich, and I got this... I got this job at a school in Norwich, which was mainly Arabs. But the pay was really good. I mean, for me, you know, I was paid by the hour. I wasn't a permanent contract. So I worked at that school for about a year. And then the school moved to London. So I thought, well, I'm going to follow it, because I wanted to do this. In order to teach English as a foreign language by that time, you had to have this certificate, really, to get anywhere. Okay, I forget what you call it now, but it's a, you know, teaching.
TEFL.
TEFL, that was it. So I had to have the TEFL. So I went to London, lived with Vajra... What's his name? Doctor. Not Vajran, a friend of Vajran's. What's his name? And then went to Africa to teach in Africa. Anyway, he married Shirley, who is a black woman. And I lived in this flat, very nice flat, King's Cross, with Shirley and Vajra, Veera Bhadra.
Oh, Veera Bhadra.
Veera Bhadra. Lovely man. And I was their tenant for a year. And I did the TEFL course in London. Month intensive, and then I had my spiritual meltdown.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, have you ever seen a film called Torch Song Trilogy?
No.
It was a very good film, it's about this transvestite who sings in performs in a nightclub, and it's a good film. I won't go into it, but I went with Vajrananda, and it had a very powerful effect. We were on our backs. We'd sort of locked our bikes onto the railings, and I was unfastening my bike. And I said to Vajrananda, I feel absolutely dead, I said. I said, I'm an order member. I'm supposed to be developing as an individual. I've got nowhere, or something like that, you know. I just felt utterly stifled and stuck. And I was having these real dreams, really powerful dreams. And the climactic dream was this monster in a cage. But interesting, it's in the cage in a suburban garden, a little nice suburban garden, where the wife's got her pinny on and doing her little sandwiches. And there's this beast shaking with rage in it.
Gosh.
And I went to London, and I wrote into Shabda, and I told them everyone about my spiritual meltdown. And Bhante wrote a card to me immediately afterwards, and he said, I really appreciated what you wrote, and I can see you are going through a spiritual crisis. And he said, but I don't think it's because of the Catholicism. I laid a lot of it at Catholicism's door. It's anyway, if you want to talk about it, I'd be into it. So I went down to LBC, who was living in that little flat, and we talked about it. And all I remember saying to him, I said, look, Bhante, I told him about that. I said, that dream, I said, that is my energy. I said to him, I said, and I want it. And there's no way I'm not going to go for it.
Yeah.
He said, oh, well, I suppose then the question arises, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to go abroad. Ah, that's a good idea. My idea was to go to Spain, teach English, foreign language. He said, yes, that's a good idea. He said, go abroad. And he said, take all the hats off. He didn't say that, but like chairman, Mitra Convener, teaching meditation, all that, just chuck it off, even dress differently. You know. So I went to Japan.
Yeah.
Because Bodhananda, a friend of mine, was working there. And he wrote to me saying that the head of the school was looking for a teacher part-time for 2 months because one of the teachers had gone on a long honeymoon. So I applied for this job and got a visa. But you could only get a working permit for a year. So I did my 2 months and it went okay. I thought, well, the money was so good. So why not stay? So I stayed for 4 years.
4 years?
And I earned a lot of money. But one good thing was my son, who is now a freelance photographer, very good, he was just beginning his photography and he got this place in, I think it was the London Printing School, where they had a photography department. It was very, very well known. But he didn't get any funding. So for the first time in my life, I could send money to my children. I remember writing a cheque in my flat in Tokyo, £500. It was a great feeling. But that was difficult, going to teaching this school in Tokyo, where you know one. You know, I'd be chairman, resident, you know, leading study groups for people looking up to me. So I was no one, you know, people just... The headmaster telling me what to do, and people not really in very good communication, you know. It was really quite the adjustment, the withdrawal symptoms. But it was a good thing to do. It was interesting living in a foreign country.
Did you learn Japanese?
A bit, but my hearing was going then, and it's very important. Japanese isn't a difficult language to speak, but the consonants are extremely important. X, z, s. You know, and my ear wasn't picking them up. But it was good fun, and I learnt a bit of the writing. That was interesting. And I had a lot of contact with Bodhananda, who has become a very good friend of mine.
So where are we now? We've got to the
late 80s? That's 1995. I went in 1991. And 1995 I came back, and then I lived with Vajrananda in Cambridge. And with Vajrananda and, for a time, Dharmavira and Shanti Garba. And I was in Cambridge for 4 years, till 1999. Then I went to Vajrakuta to become part of the teaching team there.
That was when it was a study centre, when Vajrakuta was a study centre.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was a different movement when I came back in 1995.
In what way?
Things had developed and I'd not been involved and, you know, I didn't fit in really. But eventually I made my way back into the heart of things. You know.
What would you say was different?
I think it's just that I'd been out of the way of the way the movement's working and people were different, you know. I'd not been involved. I didn't know where to go, as it were. It wasn't substantially different, but circumstantially different it was.
So you were living at Vajrakuta as part of a community there running the retreat centre?
Yes.
Who else was there? Who else was there?
Nagapriya. A Swiss guy called Walter Kirtley, who became Akasha Vera, and he very shortly afterwards left and went somewhere and met this Chinese girl, and we didn't really see him again. But I had a card, not a card, on Facebook there was a message on my 80th birthday from Akash Avira.
Aww, that's lovely.
Wow, you know, you're 80, you know, happy birthday. Who else was? Rat Laguna was there, but he was going through his meltdown by that time. He was going through quite a real crisis. So that made it difficult. Because he was the kingpin there when I arrived. It wasn't brilliant, but it was very good to lead the seminars. I did a lot of study, and I led a lot of seminars. That taught me a lot. So it's very good dharmically, but the community situation was extremely difficult.
So were they seminars in the mould of Bhante's seminars,
well,
taking a text
was
and working
the order course.
Right.
We'd started this order course, or Subhuti had, and Rat Laguna was also shaping it. So we were teaching these courses, and order members were coming. I think it was study was, being a study leader was, you had to go to Vajrakuta at the time. So you got a lot of people there, some of them reluctant because they didn't really want to, but they had to if they wanted to become study leaders. So I had a real array of people, men and women, and it was a good experience learning to be in groups and be the so-called specialist in a way, you know, teaching this order course. It was quite challenging. But and then we were going to buy a new study centre. That all fell through last minute. We were gazumped. We were going to buy this house in North Wales on the coast. We were gazumped at the last minute. And I was not devastated, but really disappointed at the time, but really glad it didn't happen. After a few months, I realised I'd have been left there. Rat Laguna's had his meltdown. Nagapriya was so unhappy and didn't. So I realised afterwards I would have been left there with, you know, trying to run this big. Wouldn't have worked.
So was it after that that, because at some point Vajrakuta became Dharmavastu.
Yeah, that's while I was there.
Right.
We had all these meetings, and we decided to change the whole approach, call it Dharmavastu.
What does that mean?
I can't remember. Vastu is something like realm, I think.
Ah, right.
Maybe. But that never caught on. And then the whole project collapsed. And that was hard. Because we felt a sense of failure, you know. Although we had done a lot of good work, the fact that the project had collapsed. So I thought, well, what the hell do I do now? Well, I had some friends in Birmingham who were living at Majimaloka, like Nagapodi and Sona and all that lot. And I visited them a few times and it had been nice. So I thought, well, why not? So I went to Birmingham in 2003.
So you were there quite a long time.
And I was there, yeah, quite a long time. Where did I go after Birmingham?
Brighton.
Went to Brighton from Birmingham.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 2003 to 2011. 8 years. Living in that community in Park Road with Dharmashura, Jyoti, Light. Jyoti is Light, Tara Vandana's boyfriend.
Stira Jyoti.
He was there. A few more people. And not really having any responsibility. Although I did some input on the Dharmavastu course, Dharma Dutta course.
Oh, the Dharma Dutta course.
Yeah.
With Saramati.
With Saramati and Sagramati. And I had a lot of contact with Sagramati. That's where I really got to know him. He's a very good friend of mine. So we've had lots and lots of Dharma exchanges. And that was really good. That was quite stimulating.
And at some point, you've ordained some people.
And then I became a private preceptor to Sinavarchin.
Oh, yeah.
You know him?
Yeah.
Who is still living in that house in Birmingham, going to stay there on Sunday. And then he and I, we've not had much contact recently, he and I are going to London together on Monday and going to the Abstract Expressionism exhibition, which I've already seen, but I really want to see again. So I'm spending the day with Sinavarchin, catch up with him, and then go back to Brighton.
So it's quite a tour, this 80th birthday tour.
I know.
Up to Norwich, across to Bristol, up to Adishtana, Adishtana to Birmingham.
Yeah. Birmingham. I was going to extend it to Wales, but I thought, no, I just haven't got the stamina. See Hridayah. Hridayah's a good friend of mine. Andrew Pushpa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Bernananda's there now. He's moved. He still teaches at Vajraloka, but he's got himself a flat in Llangollen.
Ah, right.
So I would have stayed with him for a day, and then Hridayah and Vajrapushpa for a day or two, and then back to Brighton. But I thought, come on, Abhay. I know you're still mobile, but you are 80, and you know. That's it, really.
Wow. So did you ordain anyone else?
There are two more people. There's Abhaya Siddhi, who is a Scottish person who worked in Windhorse Trading. While I was in Cambridge, I had two jobs. One was admin at the centre, and the other was a sort of Kalyana Mitra post at Windhorse Trading. And Sona asked me if I would ordain Sinavarchin. Because he wanted Robin Cooper.
Oh, yeah, Ratnaprabha.
Ratnaprabha to ordain him. But for fears, I don't know why it didn't happen. Anyway, I did.
Abhaya Siddhi, you mean?
Eh?
You mean Abhaya Siddhi?
No,
Sinavarchin, right.
And Abhaya Siddhi, I also ordained him. And then Padmadeepa. And they were all Windhorse Trading people. So that's how I came to be a private preceptor. And once I'd left Cambridge, I no longer had contact with Mitras, really. I wasn't going to the Birmingham Centre, so. But then I was asked to be a public preceptor after 1 year in Birmingham. And I did. I agreed to it. And I was a public preceptor until I went on this 3 month solitary retreat, which was so life transforming for me, you know. And on that retreat, the voice in my head say, "You've stopped being a public preceptor, stop doing all that sort of thing, and just be." And I thought, yeah, okay. So I went back and I announced to the public preceptors at a meeting. I talked about my experience on the solitary retreat. I said, I just don't want to do this anymore. And I thought they were going to say, well, I think, you know, perhaps you should meditate, blah, 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 blah. And they all said, okay. So I stopped. And then I was still living in Birmingham. But my good friends, Dharma Mati and Vajrananda, are both artists, had left. They'd gone to Brighton, and Padmapani was there. So I thought, well, why, you know, I'm so into painting and drawing, why not join them? So I did.
There's quite a thread of you following a strong inner prompting.
Bhante says,
had to be on my way.
What, sorry?
Bhante says in the story about him, after Dr. Ambedkar died, well, before he knew Ambedkar died, he had a sense he had to be on his way.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's exactly like that, but I have that sense of you followed where your intuition has prompted strongly.
That's right, that's right. Yeah. Almost in a way that there's no way I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
You know. So maybe they could sense, maybe the public preceptors actually sense that, the way they weren't going to try and persuade me.
Well, I'm still interested in that beast in the cage in the suburban garden.
Wow, yeah, that's a powerful image.
And you saying that's my energy and I want it. Do you feel that you claimed that energy?
To some extent, not completely. I think it's a lifetime's work, mostly. Because of my particular conditioning, I think it's made it very difficult. Not just, well, Catholic conditioning and family conditioning, very, very strong. And of course I broke away from that, but it's still in your blood, as it were. So the freeing of energy in that sense is very difficult. But I committed myself to it, and I think through my various pursuits of one kind or another, including painting, and you know, I have released quite a lot of that energy and made it available. And I think my dream life has been very powerful since the beast in the cage, and things happen in my dreams which I think are quite, in a way, sort of archetypal, and there's something happening down below that's working out. That's what I feel.
It sounds like, and in you, there is a fidelity to that.
So you've got to be yourself. I mean, that's what it's about. Like when I came out of that cinema with Vajrananda in 1985, whatever it was, you know, it was like, no way was I going to carry on that. So, yeah, I think it's useful talking to one person. I've told my life story to a lot of people, you know, with groups. But to tell it to you, I mean, I've said more than I thought, but I think it's because you can get immediate feedback. And I think it's been very useful for me to do that.
Well, it's a real delight to hear. Sardaloka said the other day, I heard him say he thought that telling life stories is one of Tri Ratna's esoteric practices.
I can see the landscape, you know, like, you've come that far and you turn around and you turn, it's like a landscape that you can see what you've done and how it's been difficult, but it's also been very fulfilling.
It's
very enjoyable too in many ways. Don't want to give the impression that it's all been hell. You know.
But not easy.
But not easy.
Yeah.
Because you have to follow the voice.